You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Tracy Ross.
And I'm Melissa Peterson, subbing in for Rebecca Vallis.
And we're excited to have you on air finally, Alyssa, since you are one of the great co-producers that make this show possible.
Making my radio debut. Wish me luck, Tracy.
You don't need it. I'm confident in you. But first, before we dive into anything, I just want to give a nod to Rebecca, who's gone this week. She spent the day in Pennsylvania yesterday testifying at a hearing on criminal justice reform. She's been pushing a clean slate campaign. Essentially, this policy would allow individuals with nonviolent misdemeanor convictions to earn a clean slate upon rehabilitation, since people with criminal records face many barriers to employment. So this policy was just endorsed by the Philly Daily News. So Rebecca's doing great things right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'd be remiss not to mention last week in Charleston, South Carolina, 9 people were murdered by a white supremacist, and the thoughts of everyone on the show goes out to those families. But there's also been a remarkable amount of conversations now in the past week about race, about violence, about even the Confederate flag. And actually, Alyssa, you brought up something interesting to me about Meet the Press that was trying to have one of these conversations. Can you tell me a bit about what Meet the Press did?
Yeah, so Meet the Press, trying to remain hip and relevant, decided to put together a collection of videos to look at convicted murderers and the effect on gun control. But in Meet the Press fashion, they assembled an excellent panel of Chuck Todd and David Brooks to comment and said convicted murderers. And did I mention, all of the convicted murderers in the video relating to Charleston are all African American. So they took essentially a crime of a white supremacist, completely derailed the conversation, took it away from the Confederate flag, took it away from race, and made it this All Lives Matter conversation that we've been all fighting to get away from.
And this is something that people have been pushing back on this. They got some heat for this, right? They had to have.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, people have been saying it's the worst decision Meet the Press has made in years for their editorial content.
I was going to say, it's pretty tone deaf to, I think I read something that said that they'd already had the video made, and they made the decision, like, we're going to still air this video about convicted murderers who were using gun violence. But, you could hold off on this when there's really important conversations about race happening, rather than saying, it's kind of the whole, like, but what about black on black crime kind of discussions.
Oh, yeah. They went Mayor Giuliani on this one. And to add to it, in the video, they have all these black convicted murderers advising their 12-year-old selves about how not to murder people. And then on top of that, this entire social responsibility argument, they have David Brooks, the patriarch of the racist social responsibility argument, on this panel to completely undermine the conversation we're supposed to be having.
God. But there have been some, I guess, positive developments, too, in terms of conversations about race. We saw that President Obama made some, I think, important remarks on a podcast this week, the WTF podcast, although people were focusing on his use of the N-word more than anything.
Yeah, really? Really? They just exactly proved his point.
Right.
But that's all the headlines. It was amazing.
I know. And the thing that struck me is that people kept saying Obama uses the N-word. You would have thought that he was in his motorcade, rolled down the window, and saw a black person on the street and shouted it out. He didn't use it. He cited it.
Yeah. He cited it. He quoted it.
Right.
Quoted it. So unbelievable.
But another important development has been around the Confederate flag. And I guess just earlier this week, the governor of Alabama took down the flag over the state capitol. We see that in the South Carolina state legislature, they're discussing taking it down. Governor Nikki Haley called for it to be removed. I mean, I think some of the reasons that people are citing are still a little obtuse, saying, well, it offends some people, but at least I think that this is some change.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's leading to a lot of great grassroots activism on the ground. I think Progress did a video, a really powerful video. I encourage everyone to check it out on their website, highlighting the protesters and seeing people from all different backgrounds and different beliefs, people whose ancestors had died fighting for the Confederacy, commenting about how this was wrong. We've seen a Move On petition get over 500,000 signatures, making it one of the fastest ever. There's a petition in encouraging Mississippi to also take down the flag that's getting some traction. So hopefully we can capitalize on this moment and take down that racist symbol once and for all.
Absolutely. I think sometimes people are dismissive and saying, well, you know, this is a symbol. It doesn't signify a huge change. But I think it's really shifting the way people are thinking about race. I just wanted to quote this member of the South Carolina State Legislature who said that it is a poor reflection on me that it took the violent death of my former desk mate in the South Carolina Senate and eight others of the best of the Charleston community had to offer to open my eyes to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I commend, I guess, all the conservatives out there who are taking steps to remove the symbol. I mean, Rush Limbaugh, he said that he thinks that, you know, next stop is the American flag.
But oh, God.
To people who say that, you know, the American flag has flown over injustices. It has flown over slavery and other things. But at its best, it has always stood for the ideals that all men are created equal. The Confederate flag never had that beacon of hope for most of the country. So
yeah, absolutely. So Tracy,
yes,
who are we having on this episode?
Well, this episode, you know, speaking of grassroots movements, it's looking at the role that the arts play in social change. And we're kicking things off with Meg Noe, who's the curator of David Weinberg Photography, a gallery in Chicago. And we also get to talk to Billy McGinnis, who is a Chicago-based artist. And we also talk to a good friend of mine, Ben Stone, who is the executive director of Station North Arts and Entertainment, Inc. So we've got a great show ahead. You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Tracy Ross. David Weinberg Photography, located in Chicago, is a gallery committed to educating and informing the public on issues of social justice. To discuss their work, I'm joined by Meg Noe, curator and director of education for the gallery. So welcome to the program, Meg.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what made you all change the focus of the gallery to one of social justice?
It was a lot of just hosting things. As a gallery, you know, you're kind of left with this big vacant space when people aren't in it at the end of the day. You know, you put things on the wall and you want people to engage with them. So a part of what we were trying to do is, you know, nonprofits were coming to use the space to talk about their work, to host events, to host meetings. And that was sort of a regular thing we had been doing for a while. David is intimately connected with a lot of social justice networks in Chicago. And so he was always sort of involved with giving them support by allowing them to use our space. That sort of filtered into our ethos in a way. We started to think about if we're already dedicating this much time to these organizations, how can we further that interest? Because that seemed to be where our hearts were. You know, as a gallery, I don't think that we're fully sold on the idea of a purely capitalist endeavor or playing into the market. And especially when you're working with this sort of material, it's not something to try and commodify. Although selling the work supports the artists in a way that helps them to continue to make these projects, to engage with these communities, and that is deeply important. It's also insanely important that we support these nonprofits that are doing this work. So I think that's how we arrived at that decision together.
And in what ways do you think that art can help various social justice movements that are occurring?
You know, I think that there's so many different ways to begin to think about how art can help society, whether it's talking about a sort of missing link in representation or the simple act of expression, art giving communities a voice, individuals a voice. It's funny that you ask me this because this morning I had read a quote, and the last line of this quote, it's by Beaumont Newhall, who's writing a letter to Ansel Adams, and the last line of this quote, he says, "These are days when eloquent statements are needed." And I think during such turbulent times that we're in, we're seeing a lot of injustices surface, and we're all sort of facing them in a very aggressive way. And I think that the questioning, the introspection, the ways that we adjust ourselves is necessary in how we also view art. You know, art sort of lends us to a deeper sense of questioning. And I think that that's a very powerful and unique thing that art allows people to do. You enter a new world, a new perspective.
With this new space that you've created for these artists focused on various social justice issues, have you seen, you know, new conversations sparked or new connections with nonprofits in the area? You know, what results so far have you seen from this shift in your gallery?
You know, I think some of the results of our show are hard to measure. I think that the idea that change happens in a large way is silly. You know, the smaller things are what we're sort of trying to measure that accumulate in advocating for an issue or community building. And I think it's a difficult thing to address because when working with these nonprofits, some of the things that they benefit from are deeply political. We can't actually talk about them publicly. But, you know, like getting to put together programming where someone from Tony Preckwinkle's office can sit in conversation with lawyers at the ACLU, two people who are constantly at suit with each other, and see them come together and talk about issues that they both are passionate about changing, and learn that they're on the same team, but they struggle through bureaucracy and the sort of systemic hurdles that keep them from being on the same team all the time. That's sort of like a bigger perspective of what the like programming engagements we do in the gallery produces. But also, you know, seeing community members come in and interact with the work, whether it's content that they've never experienced before, issues that they've never considered, or things that they're deeply passionate about, that's one of the more profound moments of being in the space and seeing these interactions all the time. You know, like our first show was talked about the gun violence on the south and west side of Chicago, photographs by Carlos Javier Ortiz. And so seeing those community members come into the space and seeing, you know, a memorial wall and really feeling the compassion of the artist and knowing that there was someone in the world that wanted to represent their struggle in a way that gave them hope, in a way that gave them a voice. You know, those sorts of small gestures are infinitely profound.
And you're currently running an exhibit called An Invisible Hand.
Yes.
And on your site, it says that attempts to unpack the many diverse experiences of poverty. Can you tell us a bit about that exhibit and discuss some of the works on display?
Right. So the show is in partnership with the Sargent Shriver National Center on Poverty Law. And when we initiated a partnership with them, we had talked a lot about, you know, what would this show look like? How could it benefit their organization or their advocacy in some way? And we sort of talked and bounced around ideas about what that could look like, whether we would sort of put together a show that talked about one facet of their work, because they have a holistic view of policy writing for poverty. So, you know, I think after lots of discussion, we sort of realized that it's not quite possible to isolate their issues into silos. For example, we couldn't put together a show on simply housing issues. In Chicago is a huge city that talks about public housing all the time, and there's tons of work, photographs and artwork and socially engaged projects that talk to that. But we couldn't talk about that without talking about all of the other issues that sort of become intrinsically linked. Like, you can't talk about housing without talking about tenants' rights or workers' rights or domestic violence. So in putting together that exhibition, I wanted to try and illustrate how complex and complicated the issues are. So there's work that talks about deep poverty. There's work that talks about migrant workers in North Dakota. And the issues that revolve around that do include housing. They do include the criminalization of the poor. So that's sort of how I tried to envision their work through a curatorial project.
Before I let you go, you know, what exhibits can we expect from the gallery in the future?
So the next exhibition talks about environmental rights, and it's in partnership with Open Lands. It's a nature conservancy organization in the Midwest. We plan to do an exhibition with the Center on Halsted here in Chicago on trans identity. So a lot of the programming is being led by the partners. And of course, there's always the unique opportunity that we meet someone and their work is just so striking that we have to pair them with a silo of political engagement. So hopefully lots of good stuff to come.
Our guest is Meg Noe, curator and director of education for the David Weinberg Photography Gallery. Thanks so much for joining us. And where can our listeners find more information about your gallery?
Our website is d-weinberg.com.
Great. Thanks so much for joining.
Thank you so much.
I'm now joined by Billy McGinnis, a Chicago-based artist whose work is currently on display as part of the exhibit An Invisible Hand at David Weinberg Photography. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Tracy.
So we're really interested in this exhibit space because it's unique that a gallery would dedicate itself to social justice. Have you, as an artist, always been interested in having your work geared towards social justice?
Oh, that's a really good question. I guess the short answer is no, not always. I think it was an evolution for me. You know, I began making work as a very young person and was sort of really excited to create beautiful objects or images. But as I matured and got more serious about, you know, what I wanted to do with my life, it became apparent to me that concerns that I had about social issues could not be kept out of my work. And so it was a very natural evolution to bring those feelings, those thoughts, those ideas into my art practice. But it took some time.
What are some of the issues that you're most compelled to focus on in your art and why?
Well, I think, you know, and as your show is called Talk Poverty, I think we could start there. You know, I'm a bit of a generalist, so I'm sort of really preoccupied with poverty as a big, broad spectrum issue. And then the various manifestations of it in the places where we live. I happen to live in Chicago. And so I live in a city that has a very high rate of homelessness. I live in a city that has a very high rate of incarceration. I live in a city that's hungry. So, you know, in broad strokes, those three issues are aspects of poverty that really are of concern to me. You know, when someone is cut off from avenues of growth, then incarceration becomes a very real possibility. When someone is cut off from access to quality education, quality food, it's hard to find employment, and so on. And so those are the issues that keep me awake at night.
In your artist statement on your website, you write, "In an age of rampant cynicism and growing apathy, my work is a means of engaging with other people, opening up to their experience, and building understanding between us." Can you elaborate on that and how you think art can be a vehicle for connecting people?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. And thanks so much for finding and reading my artist statement. I really do think art is a means of having an experience. And that can be, you know, in the most basic sense, going to a space where art is on display and seeing it, right? But when we think about art in a deeper and broader sense, we have to go to process. And so for me, first and foremost, there's this experience of the making of the work. And I like to approach my work as a passport. My process becomes a passport for me to have certain experiences that I want to have. So if I'm preoccupied with people who are hungry in the city of Chicago, my art can be a way to connect with those people. So for instance, I want to place a canvas in a soup kitchen. Oh, now I've got a reason to go to a soup kitchen. Talk with the people who work there, who run the space, talk with the people who are clients of the space and have a certain experience. And then coming out of that experience, that primary experience that I have with the people in the space, an image or an object may result that will provide a secondary experience for the art audience.
And so how do you use those images then later to connect with people viewing the art?
Well, for instance, the work that's in the David Weinberg show right now, I was thinking about spaces. So I just mentioned the soup kitchen, homeless shelter, Cook County Jail. I was thinking about the people in those spaces, the architecture itself, the building itself, and how do you bring that to an audience? And because my background's in filmmaking, my first instinct is to pick up a camcorder you know, and go make a very thoughtful and provocative documentary film about this issue. That's my first instinct. But I have to question that instinct, and I do, because my fear is that, although there are many really incredible documentaries that I'm very glad exist, my fear is that what a documentary can do is allow an audience member to sit in the comfort of their home or the comfort of a theater and gain access to lives without putting anything on the line themselves. In other words, you see a glossy image, it's of a face, you hear a voice, and you think, oh, I know that story, I feel that person's experience, I'm closer to that issue, when in fact you're not much closer. You're still where you were beforehand, and you have a momentary experience that ends all too quickly. I don't have a magic solution to what I perceive to be that problem. However, that's what I'm wrestling with. And so rather than creating images, as my instinct might be, in the various spaces that I'm interested, I've laid blank canvas on the floor to be marked up over time by the passage of the people in that space. These become abstractions, and they're hung on the wall. It's a canvas on the wall. It's abstract. And it looks a lot like abstract painting. But at the same time, it's a real thing. The marks that you see on the canvas weren't made by me in a studio somewhere. They were made by the footsteps of real human beings in a real space. They were made by coffee being spilled or blood. And so they simultaneously function on the one hand as these abstractions that remind you how far away these places really are. And on the other hand, they function as actual artifacts of a place and of a people, which hopefully would allow an audience member to get a little bit closer to an experience that is otherwise relatively far away.
Can you describe for us your favorite piece that's currently part of that exhibit, An Invisible Hand?
Oh, sure. You know, that's really tough because...
I was going to say, it might be like asking you to choose your favorite child.
It is true. And it's funny, too, because I think for the most part, most of what an artist makes, they look at and just think, eh. But with the canvases in this show, I'm really attached to each and every one of them, and each one has a story. Each one has a life of its own that is precious to me. Although if I had to pick, there's one piece called The Women's Dormitory, which is from, it's a very uncreative title, but it's from the women's section of homeless shelter on the west side of Chicago. And it was there for 3 months, and as you might imagine, it's quite dirty. But the canvases each have their own life, and the patterns that get created are very unique, and really from one to the next, they are quite different. And this canvas just has a certain energy about it that, for me, resonates something so human. There's a pattern of wear that looks like stretch marks or cellulite. And I look at that and I feel the bodies. So for me, that's the most evocative of the canvases, although as you suggest, I love them all.
And so you mentioned some of your source materials. You mentioned, you know, dirt from the bottom of shoes, drippings from coffee. What's the process like of that? I mean, you're in these spaces. Are you kind of going and hoping that something will happen? Are you surprised by what comes out of the process?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think I went into this having a certain, you know, expectation based on, you know, other work that I'd made that was a, you know, material investigation that something would come that would be visually interesting. But I couldn't possibly have anticipated the variety of marks. I have one canvas that isn't in the show. It's this really long, narrow piece. It's 22 feet long by 3 feet wide. 3 feet high. And it was down also in the homeless shelter. And this was in the main entrance for the men who used the facility. And this is, you know, 200 plus men every night, every bed full, coming in and going out of this corridor. And the variety of marks are just, you could never anticipate or imagine what that would look like. I had the experience of going to the shelter to check on the work. I'd been out of town for a couple of weeks. I'd been away from it. I wanted to go and check in with the people there and check on the work. And the assistant director who was in charge that day said, oh, you know, we need to paint lines on the floor for emergency purposes. So if you could take the canvas up today, that'd be great. So you know, this is an element of control I'm happy to give up. You know, I'll defer to the people that run the space. And I gathered up the canvas and put it in a bag and took it off to my studio without really looking at it. And I had a great deal of doubt about the whole prospect of his process and whether or not anything would result that was meaningful. And gathered up the canvas and stuffed it in the bag, as I said, and got back to the studio and sort of found a big open floor space in the hallway and unrolled this thing. And as soon as I saw it in the calm and quiet of this empty corridor and could really just be with the work, I was blown away, just really blown away by the power and the beauty of these unintended marks. And it was a moment that really restored my faith, because I think that, you know, art in particular among human endeavors is one where there's a great deal of doubt and a great deal of anxiety. I mean, we deal in questions. We don't deal in answers. And those questions can be really, you know, frightening. And then you have these moments, these breakthrough moments where something answers back and says, yes, you've found something here.
So what have you learned personally about Chicago through this process that you've gone through for these works?
Well, that's a great question, another great question. Because as I said early on, you know, the work is a passport for me to have a certain experience. So beginning with the soup kitchen, you know, that was an opportunity for me to get connected with services that are being offered to people who are hungry, not all homeless, many of them homeless, many of them almost there. And I became a volunteer at the soup kitchen for the duration of the time that the canvas was down there, and formed a relationship with the people there and formed a connection with the people there that carried me through into and through the next few efforts. And so my next experience was with the homeless shelter, and this was a sort of deepening of my connection with that population. And that manifested in, and it quite literally came out of the canvas work, a new collaboration with another Chicago-based artist and academic named Rhoda Rosen, who's my terrific partner. And we've initiated a new project called Red Line Service, which has brought us out to the 95th Street and Howard stations of Chicago's Red Line, which is one of the all-night lines of the L, where homeless Chicagoans will live, particularly during the winter months. We've gone out overnight from midnight till dawn with food, table, chairs, under the heat lamp, and hung out and met the people who spend their nights riding the train. And it's been an extraordinary education. You ask, you know, what have I learned? And what I've learned is that, you know, when you look at a problem like homelessness monolithically, it's almost impossible to imagine the incredible variety. It is impossible to imagine the incredible variety of stories and situations that lead individual human beings to that state. So we've met people that are incredibly well-educated, bright, talented, capable human beings who, through, you know, a set of circumstances, family illness, loss of job, and so on, have wound up in a situation where the train is the best place to sleep at night, the safest and most convenient place to spend your night. And I think in getting to know these people, I've begun to realize how incredibly close we really are.
Our guest is Billy McGinnis, a Chicago-based artist whose work is currently on display as part of the exhibit An Invisible Hand at the David Weinberg Photography Gallery. Thanks so much for joining us. And where can our listeners find more information about your work?
Well, there's my website, which is www.billymcginnis.com.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Tracy. It's been a pleasure.
And it's time for the Weekly Worst. But this week, we have a special guest filling in for Rebecca. Once again, Alyssa Peterson, our producer, is joining us. Thanks, Alyssa.
Happy to be finally able to participate in the segment instead of just watching behind the glass.
Usually she just gives a thumbs up or laughs at us in our disgust over the stories. And as always, we're joined by Alan Pike of Think Progress.
Hello, hello.
So what stories do you have for us this week?
Okay, first up is a woman named Monica Stitt who must repay almost $40,000 in student loan debts, even though she's bankrupt and lives on about $10,000 a year in disability and other public assistance payments. That's from an appeals judge who decided that he agreed with Stitt that she'd be unable to maintain a basic standard of living if she's forced to make even minimal payments on her loans, but decided to enforce the debts anyway. And the case sort of illustrates how bankruptcy law has been reshaped to make it almost impossible to get out of student loan debts, even if you're destitute, which is something that helps to ensure that American students and graduates are carrying around this sort of debt overhang that holds back the economy as a whole.
So to make sure I'm hearing this right, the judge agreed with her that this was a burden, but essentially his hands were bound by the law. Is that it? Or?
Well, sort of yes and sort of no. Bankruptcy law with regard to student loans is murky, is mostly based on case law, which just means what other judges have done in the past. Judges have a sort of free hand here. But basically what happened is that he decided that on a couple of the tests they look at, yes, she should be able to discharge these. But on the third, which is did you make a good faith effort to pay this back and just fail to do so, he decided that because she had used a little bit of income that she earned in 2008 to pay down credit card debt instead of trying to pay down her student loan debts, that she had not made a good faith effort. And so even though, again, she's getting by on about $10,000 a year and owes what is now with interest accumulated over the years $37,000 in student loan debts, she has to find a way to pay that back, even though she pretty much can't.
Well, that's just awful.
Right, right. They're saying you made a reasonable decision, and yet that's not a good faith effort, that you're balancing out these various debts. All right, let's move on. What's the next one?
Next is Uber. Everybody loves Uber, right? Let's get a car.
Some mixed emotions. Mixed experiences with their drivers.
Well, yeah, and sure. And if you're not white, it can be the only way that you can get a cab in some cities, I've been told. But we're talking about Uber because they say that they're remaining committed to their current business model, which denies a lot of basic workplace benefits to their drivers, despite a ruling from the California Labor Commission that the company's driver contracts constitute an employer-employee relationship. So Uber currently treats their drivers as independent contractors, which means they don't have to pay overtime, they don't have to pay payroll taxes, a bunch of other things that save Uber a bunch of money, and leave the drivers exposed in the event that a ride gets canceled and they don't get paid, things like that. So a woman who has been an Uber driver for a number of years brought suit saying, look at this contract, I'm clearly an employee, not a contractor. The California Labor Commission ruled in her favor, and Uber is pointing out that, look, that ruling doesn't apply statewide, it's not automatically enforcing across all of our contracts, we're appealing this, we don't know what'll happen, but it really only applies to this one woman. The thing is, any other driver in the state could right now bring a similar lawsuit and anticipate that the Labor Commission would rule potentially in the same way. And if that were to happen, that could force Uber to change their business model across the state and potentially across the country in time, which would obviously take a huge bite out of their profit margins and make them look a lot more like a standard cab company and a lot less like a disruptive tech genius enterprise.
So there's a little bit of weekly best in there that this could set some wheels in motion for change. But
yeah,
overall,
I'm screwing up the branding.
But overall, weekly worse since they're trying to exploit workers where possible, it sounds like.
Yeah, the point is the misclassification of people who are pretty clearly employees as independent contractors, just so you can pay them less.
And also when you're looking at the root of what Uber's trying to do, cab companies have apps you can call a car.
Right.
So they're basically, the only difference between Uber really, besides the app is designed better than some of these cab companies, but they could certainly catch up, is that they are exploiting workers through independent contracting. They're using the same practices we've seen with janitors, we've seen with the rise of low-wage work. They're doing the exact same thing, and we shouldn't allow exploitation to function as disruption.
Right. Yeah, I think that's very well said.
And what's story number three?
All right, number three is Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker.
We love Scott Walker.
Our friend
that's
Scott
it.
Walker.
That's the joke.
That's it. Weekly Works.
No, Scott Walker, in a recent radio interview, derided laws meant to address the gender pay gap as attempts to, quote, pit one group against another group. And said that supporters of pay equity laws are really just interested in making more people more dependent on the government. But, of course, the laissez-faire approach to the pay gap that Walker and a lot of other conservatives favor doesn't work. The pay gap actually gets wider the more advanced degrees a woman has.
So, Tracy, who are we, if we're trying to get equal pay for equal work, what is the group, who are we disadvantaging here?
I guess we're disadvantaging the men who need to feel wealthier by having us feel poor. I feel like there's enough families in the country that would benefit from having women have equal pay because it helps men, it helps kids, it helps everyone. So it's not really pitting anyone against another group.
And what's also amazing about it is that if women had access to equal work, dependence on the government would be reduced because women could earn more money for the employment that they are currently acting in.
Right, exactly. So it's like he wants women to earn less because it'll somehow make them less dependent on government, even though they'll need more services in the end. I don't know. It's just I'm trying to make sense out of an argument that actually makes no sense. So it's I'm wasting all of our time.
Yeah, there's very little about there's very little about the debate around and even the research around pay equity stuff that's ever quite made sense to me. There's all these really odd findings about the social consequences in a marriage or in a family, depending on who's the breadwinner and who's not, and the sort of the traditional economic gender roles within a family, and how those are kind of shifting or not shifting over time. It's all very strange to me. It seems pretty clear cut that laws that are meant to make sure that you can't get disciplined for talking about your pay at work, and to make sure that your company can't knowingly underpay you compared to a male counterpart just because they're taking advantage of sort of socialized negotiating habits that are different between men and women. Things like that seem pretty straightforward to me.
So our three stories we had was first the bankruptcy case where the judge ruled that the woman was not making a good faith effort to pay down her student loans. We have the Uber story of them exploiting their workers, and then this wonderful return of Scott Walker and his pay gap funny voodoo economics. So Alyssa, since you're our guest today, why don't you vote first?
I think I have to go with Uber, if only because the decision is there. They still choose not to act on it. Because Uber is convenient, they have basically tricked the entire country of America into giving them a license to pay people badly when that's not disruption. We've fought back against that for like 70 years or so.
And I think like to your point, there's this kind of ideal that when something is, you know, techie and shiny and fast, it seems like it's more progressive, that somehow, oh, this is a company I should be utilizing. But really, you know, they are exploiting workers, but I'm not voting for it.
Oh,
good fake out. Good fake out.
I'm voting for Scott Walker just because
you always vote for Scott
I
Walker.
I know. How can I not? I'm loyal. But also, it's just, I don't even need to reiterate anything. It was just so purely idiotic that it was poetic injustice. So that's mine.
All right, I'm so we got one for Uber and one for Walker.
Yeah, so yeah. You're either a tiebreaker
so
or a third.
I can either cause chaos by voting
you
for the third.
You can also do it to an
existential crisis. I'm going to vote for the Uber story, too.
Cause I think, this is the first time I've lost,
victory.
I think.
Both because, A, I'm a dude, so clearly I'm super into pay inequity. it's that I think this is on top of everything that you just said, Alyssa, about how this preys upon our desire to sort of get on board with the cool, shiny new thing, and that obfuscates these old economic fights. I think it's also just it helps to call attention to the misclassification of workers more broadly. Mm-hmm. This is an incredibly common problem, especially in transportation-oriented industries, the shipping and trucking industry in particular. And it's dangerous in those industries because when you make truck drivers more economically insecure, you increase their incentives to drive more, and that makes the roads more dangerous. And this stuff happens across a shockingly wide variety of industries, and it's just a really cheap way for a company to save a couple thousand bucks a year per employee by essentially lying about how big a role they play in their workforce's day-to-day operations.
All right, so I lost, but you guys won with very good arguments and a very bad story. But I still would just like to say that Scott Walker is a sexist. So just going to throw that out there. But anyway, Alan, thanks for joining us. And Alyssa, thanks for joining us for the first time vocally and not just waving at us.
Yeah, excellent. Thanks.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network. I'm Tracy Ross. On today's episode, we're talking about how the arts play a role in social justice and community change. With us to discuss this further, I'm joined by a friend, Ben Stone, Executive Director of Station North Arts and Entertainment, Inc., located in Baltimore. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
So Station North was the first area in Baltimore to receive Maryland's designation as an arts and entertainment district back in 2002. What does this designation exactly mean?
Good question. So the designation is a state program, and it offers a few tax incentives, some of which are more useful than others. To be honest, most of them are not especially useful, but they really reward artists for moving into the area, making work in the area, and give them some small tax breaks for selling work in the designated area.
And so your work is focused on the Station North area, and your organization employs an arts-based revitalization and placemaking strategy. Can you explain what that strategy is and what placemaking means?
Sure. So we're an area in the center of Baltimore. We're actually right in the exact geographic center of Baltimore City, about 100 acres of the middle of the city. And we're an area that even before the designation in 2002 had a few hundred artists living and working here. So we're not sort of area where we came in or someone came in and tried to wave a magic wand to attract all the artists in a creative class to move in. We're more of an organization that looked around at the assets and decided that the arts were really something that was working in this part of Baltimore where a lot of other things weren't working, and tried to build on those assets. And the organization was actually founded by a number of the artists living and working in Station North. And the placemaking side of things is really try to use those assets to make the neighborhoods that make up Station North as attractive as they can be and make them the kind of place that people want to come to the theater, buy a home, rent a home, and open businesses in this part of the city and really get a sense of, convey a sense of how exciting it is in this part of Baltimore.
And so a lot of people, when they think of Baltimore, they've traditionally thought of The Wire. Now they're thinking a lot, obviously, about the protests that happened over the past few months. You're a native of Baltimore. And so how do you see the work that you're doing as kind of pushing back on some of these perceptions of the city?
And The Wire is always an interesting point to bring up. A lot of The Wire is actually filmed in Station North. Station North is kind of... I would describe it as a microcosm of Baltimore. There are different corners of the district that can look like any other part of Baltimore. And so a lot of it was filmed there, even though the crime rates in Station North are not as high as the areas that the neighborhood is representing. But I always push back when people talk about how we don't want Baltimore to be represented by The Wire, as saying, it's widely regarded as the greatest TV show of all time. It was created by a Baltimorean, filmed in Baltimore, starred Baltimoreans. There's no reason to not embrace it, as far as I'm concerned. And that kind of talent in Baltimore exists. And that's the sort of thing that the story that we always like to tell, that these artists and producers and actors are all living and working in Baltimore. And it's important to acknowledge that.
So what sorts of projects are you currently working on?
We do a whole bunch of different things. We're largely focused on doing kind of interim uses for larger scale development projects. We're an area where development is moving rather slowly and things start and stop. There's a lot of subsidy that goes into projects. Worldwide economy has taking its toll on a number of different things. And we end up with vacant lots, like many other areas that have future development plans that are 5, 10, 15 years out. And so we've built a couple outdoor stages where we have regular performances and workshops with people. And we do these things to both build a sense of momentum so that people understand that even though they might not be part of the conversations about raising the $16 to $17 million that are needed for the bigger project in the future, that things are still happening in the neighborhood and that they should feel as positive about the neighborhood they live in as we do. Not always that evident that things are going on behind the scenes.
And so in a recent article in the Washington Post titled "Can the Arts Save Baltimore?" they briefly discussed the creative class, the so-called professors and thinkers and artists, as a way to determine which post-industrial cities will thrive. And the article quotes you as saying such a theory can push problems to the periphery. As someone who employs an arts strategy to change communities, what is it about the creative class argument that doesn't sit well with you?
Well, yeah, it might sound like a strange comment coming from me given my role in Station North, but I think any place-based strategy that works on the neighborhood, the district, anything that has a line drawn around it has to be really aware of the boundaries of that area. And we're acutely aware of that in Station North because we, as I said earlier, we think of ourselves as the center of the city. But in reality, we are the area where the lines of police districts all cut through the district. Legislative districts all cut through here. Neighborhood lines all cut through the middle. So really kind of an in-between area. So a lot of the problems from other areas get pushed here. We're such a data-driven city, like so many other cities, and people and police want to get their numbers down in their district. So pushing crime out of one district into another is often a good strategy. That's true for neighborhoods as well. So we are, of course, interested in uplifting the people that are in the neighborhood. You can change numbers by having people living in poverty become more affluent, or you can change it by having those people not live in the neighborhood anymore. And we're very cognizant of the fact that that's often the strategy that people employ. You know, you can look at the numbers and see educational rates going up, income rates going up, and then actually look at the people and realize they all look rather different than they did 5-10 years ago. And that's something we're constantly paying attention to.
And so arts are often employed in strategies that are essentially promoting gentrification. And you're saying that you're pushing back on this. But how do you see your role in ensuring that people who are poor or have been in the neighborhood for maybe a few generations are going to be part of the changes that are occurring?
Yeah, we're often the liaison between the artists, at least, and designers living and working in the neighborhood, and so many of the other stakeholders, whether it's Johns Hopkins University, which is now partially in the neighborhood, or Maryland Institute College of Art, University of Baltimore, so many other the bigger stakeholders. And we're constantly reminding them that one of the main reasons they were attracted to the neighborhood in the first place is the artistic energy that's there, and that by maintaining that, which really just relies on having affordable spaces to live and work, they'll be able to maintain that initial spark that attracted them to the area in the first place. And artists are so interesting, and as a whole, they're generally poorer than the professional workforce, but better educated than the professional workforce. So they're kind of in this strange role of frequently living side by side with people living in poverty just out of necessity, but also having access to the media, having access to all kinds of different things because of the kind of work that they do. So it can be an interesting way of drawing attention to a lot of the problems in urban areas.
And so have you witnessed any compelling ways that some of the artists have been able to draw attention to the issues that their neighbors are facing?
Yeah, so we're working on an NEA-funded project now called Artists Within, working with 4 different organizations in Station North. And one of those organizations, run by a dancer and choreographer named DJ Phillip, called Dance and Be More, is working in our one big high-rise public housing development in Station North. And it's the kind of project where she goes in and does weekly dance and movement workshops with the residents in the building, which might sound cute and adorable, and it certainly is. But our motivation and part of her motivation in doing this is that by working closely with these residents, we're able to actually draw them out of the building. This is the building where people generally live their entire lives inside this high rise and don't really come out for much of anything for a number of reasons. But she's actually brought them out to theater production in the neighborhood and brought them to community association meetings and helped to humanize the people in this building. It's so easy to dehumanize people who are all in a building that you never actually see face to face. And we're, of course, aware that at some point in the future, there will be discussions about the future of that building. Not anytime soon, I don't think, but whether or not it maintains its affordable status or not. And it'll be so much easier for people to want to change it and change the people living in it if they've never actually met anyone living in the building. The simple act of just having people come out, share a meal, sit in the same seats at a theater production can really help to actually want to stand up for those people when it comes time to do that.
And so Baltimore has received a lot of national attention, as I mentioned moments ago, in the wake of the protests following Freddie Gray's death. How have people used the arts following the tragedy, you know, to respond to the events?
Yeah, it's been interesting. The numbers I've seen for hotel stays and some of our larger attractions are way, way down, have been down over the last couple months. But my sense from the smaller theater companies and galleries and restaurants, the ones that really rely on other Baltimoreans to patronize them, are actually up in some cases. Certainly after the curfew hurt everyone. But the arts have really proven that in times of crisis, people really want to connect with each other face to face. And when you're living in Baltimore already, you're not necessarily afraid to come into Baltimore because you can look around and realize that despite what the national media might be saying, things are not quite as chaotic all across the city as people are thinking. And we've seen artists coming together and performing. We helped sponsor an event that brought traditional Korean dancers and Beamer Club dancers together. These are two communities that have been butting heads quite a bit for generations now, but certainly during the uprising as well. And again, it's a very simple step to have people share a stage and sit in the audience together, but it's an important first step towards actually improving things in the future.
How have these recent events changed what you think your organization will be doing going forward?
I've talked to a lot of people about this. You know, what are you doing differently now that the uprising has happened? What are you changing? And my general response to that is that for me, and I think for a lot of people, if you start to change the way you do work, and in the back of your mind, you're thinking, you know, in 3 months, things will settle down, and I'll go back to what I was doing before, then you're not really, you really shouldn't be taking that approach anyway. So I think a lot of us are spending some time thinking about what we were doing before. And also, it's really an opportunity for more people to be aware of the work that was actually going on before. And the standard response after the uprising is, you know, what can we immediately do to solve problems? And everyone has a million different ideas, and suddenly people stop and look around and realize that so many people, especially those living in communities like Sandtown, are already doing that kind of work. And if we just pause and take our great ideas and try to see who out there is already working on these ideas and support them rather than trying to generate brand new ideas, I think that's the way we really can change communities.
Something that I was struck by in most protests are how activists themselves, who might not be artists or from an artistic background, but activists will use poetry or songs or, you know, even depictions of art on their posters to convey their message. Did the protests build new partners or bring together people that you haven't worked with in the past that you might work with going forward?
Yeah, for us, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. In some ways, the protests and the uprising were kind of just a blip in a very long continuum. And so many things were starting even before that, and they've kind of accelerated since then. But we certainly found new people wanting to get together and work with us. And we've had a call out for our outdoor stage for a couple of years now, and I've had quite a bit of interest in it. But in the week after the uprising, we had our phone ringing off the hook and probably 20 emails a day with people wanting to come out and perform for free just because they felt like they needed to do something. And if you're an artist or performer, then that's you generally turn to in times of crisis.
Can you describe the most memorable performances that took place on your stage?
Yeah, there's one that was, you know, not necessarily sanctioned, which is not a problem for us at all. When I came by, I think it was a day or two after the big protest, and there were just people dancing on the stage. There's a couple of dance crews that I know in Baltimore, and we have a generator, but it's locked up, and they didn't even bother calling us, and then pulled a pickup truck next to the stage and were running power off their truck battery, and a crowd of about 100 people hadn't even announced they were doing this and were just there, and people walking by helping to clean up some of the mess that was created with the protests just were stopping and kind of recharging there before they went out and launched more of the marches. And then within a few hours, there were over 1,000 people that started a march right there at the lot and then walked down to downtown.
So before I let you go, is there anything that you hope people could understand about the artistic scene in Baltimore?
Yeah, I think what's often most important to understand is, like so many other so-called scenes, it's incredibly diverse and complex, and it's hard to talk about it and use the big brush, pardon the pun, when describing all the artists in Baltimore. I mean, there are artists that are senior citizens, there are artists that are still kids, you know, everybody to a certain extent is involved in art at one point in their life, and it's hard to get a sense of what artists think about something or what artists need, because they all think different things and all need different things. So it's good to get to know individual artists and performers and then base your opinions off that.
Our guest is Ben Stone, Executive Director of Station North Arts and Entertainment, Inc., located in Baltimore. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network.
Tune in next week as we recognize the anniversary of the Civil Rights Act with some of the leaders carrying the torch today. Special thanks goes out to our co-producers Greg Kaufman and Alyssa Peterson, especially to Alyssa for filling in today.
And as always, thanks to Christiles Bacon. Take it away, Christiles.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough. And none of those could connect me with the HMO. And nowadays it's common for grandparents to outlive their grandkids. And those are the type of odds that we handling. I'm not a slave to a man with a whip. I'm a slave to the U.S. men. And they got me doing things in my life that never made any sense. But it paid me in dollars and cents. I need the money for the food and health care, the schools and bus fare. You can't pay the rent without the U.S. right there. With shackles on my hands and toes, they got a brother moving slow, but my soul is determined to go. I want freedom. Freedom. Now I don't know where it's at, but it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the map. We just trying to get freedom. What we talking about?
You are listening to the We Act Radio Network, produced in Washington, D.C. Visit us online at weactradio.com.